You're listening to the Blue Box Podcast, and for the next 60 minutes, we're going to be talking about Doctor Who so that you don't have to. Hi, I'm JR.
Hi, I'm Chris.
Hi, I'm Erica.
Hi, I'm Josh.
And the subject of tonight's episode is going to be guilty pleasures. Erica, you have a problem with that, don't you?
I absolutely do. Let me get my soapbox out here and climb up on top of it. My problem is just that I hate the phrase guilty pleasures because I don't think we should feel guilty for watching any Doctor Who because it's all awesome. Or really anything else for that matter. I don't like the idea that people should feel guilty for enjoying something. I think that it's just ridiculous. And it also smacks a little bit of sort of the fandom gatekeeping thing that seems to have everybody up in arms these days. Like, you should be guilty for liking this bit of Doctor Who because it's not the way I like Doctor Who or not the way most people like Doctor Who. And it makes me mad. A number of years ago, I realized that I like the Backstreet Boys, and I don't care what my rock and roll friends think about that. I am going to admit that I like the Backstreet Boys, and screw them if they don't. So that's...
Well, that's... Yeah. No, I agree with you. I think that's absolutely fair enough. Mm-hmm. And not only that, I mean, just very simply, if you like something, then liking it shouldn't be something you should have to feel guilty about.
Right, unless what you like is like vivisection or something, then you should maybe feel guilty about that. But
or murder or something.
Yeah, media. Yeah. I think it's okay to enjoy stuff.
Exactly. And it's Doctor Who. We should like all of it. If we're Doctor Who fans, there shouldn't be bits of it that we dislike. There may be bits of it we like less than other bits, but there shouldn't be bits of it we dislike, not really.
Out of hundreds upon hundreds of episodes, I don't think that's possible. I think there's always going to be ebbs and peaks and valleys and ebbs and flows and hatred and enjoyment.
At least there should be no things that make us dislike other people because they like them.
Oh, there's an interesting subject. I have to say, though, out of all those episodes of Doctor Who, I don't think there's any I don't get something out of. Except for maybe, actually, tonight's first story. Because what we've done is we've all gone to... Well, we sort of went to Doctor Who magazine's Mighty 200 poll. And we just picked a bunch of stories, basically out of the bottom 20, that we all think oughtn't really to be in the bottom 20, probably. Is that the best way to describe it, I guess?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we're just going to... We're just going to try and give a little bit of love to the unloved. That's what we're here for tonight. That's what I like to do. Yeah. You know, I don't think anything should have no love at all. Apart, perhaps, from tonight's first story. So, Erica, what is tonight's first story and why do you like it?
Tonight's first story is Time Lash. And I realize that there are a lot of people cringing out there right now because it is not a beloved story. But I went through kind of a Doctor Who drought sort of after my college years and didn't really watch it a lot. And it was only in the past few years that I've sort of picked it up again and tried to get back into it a lot. And Time Lash was one that I just sort of randomly selected to rewatch along with a bunch of other stuff. And I think I knew at that point that it didn't have a great reputation, but I watched it. And I found myself baffled at the end by why people hate it so much. I admit it's not the greatest story of all time, and yes, it's completely overlit, and maybe the sets aren't all that great. But if you're watching Doctor Who for sets and costumes, you're watching it for a very different reason than I am. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with the story. I liked Colin Baker just fine. I really can't stand Perry at all, but I managed to ignore her in this story for the most part. And I quite liked, and I remember this from seeing it as a child when it was first on, I really liked the idea of the Borad, you know, pretending to be a normal person and taking over this taking over this whole society. And then, yeah, H.G. Wells was very annoying, but we get annoying characters in Doctor Who all the time. And I remember being a little kid and having my little mind just blown at the end when they revealed who he actually turns out to be. Because even as a little kid, I grew up with geek parents, so I knew who H.G. Wells was. And I just, and then the Borad possibly being the Loch Ness Monster, that stuck with me for my entire life. This is a story that has rooted itself in my psyche, so I enjoy it.
It's cool. Actually, you know, you've just listed a load of great things that in another story may have worked really well. And you're right. I always say this. I always say, if the production's not up to scratch, since when was that ever a problem in Doctor Who? Because if you look at the 60s, hardly any of the productions there are really, you know, top notch. Mm-hmm. And you look at Sylvester McCoy, a lot of those stories have got really great ideas and acting and dialogue and a great story, but they're very cheap looking. You can't really designate cheapness as a reason not to like a story. Mm-hmm. But Chris, Josh, how do you two feel about Time Lash?
Time Lash is something I've never completely hated. It is a mostly dire story, with dire portrayals and dire sets and dire lighting. And,
oh, but come on, come on. Don't you just, I have to.
Oh, come on, Vina. No, Vina, no. No, Vina.
I think she's that bad.
Oh, yeah, she is.
Yeah, she is.
Paul Darrow, no.
Yeah, Paul Darrow.
Wait. I love Paul Darrow chewing scenery. Come on.
That's all he does.
That's all he does.
I have slightly mixed feelings about Paul Darrow in this, because he's just so sexy and dashing in Blake 7. But here, he's pretty creepy. So.
Well, he is, and
but he's supposed to be.
If the makeup people had given him a mustache, he'd be twirling it the whole time.
Yes,
but
yes, I like that kind of cartoony aspect.
He was actually twirling his non-existent mustache.
Oh yeah,
I will concede one point to you, Erica, that I love the notion of the Borad being one thing and presenting this public image of something completely separate. David Cameron comes to mind, but it's any excuse to get Dennis Carey back there is fine by me. So
right, I'll Professor Chronotis.
Yes, and or the keeper as well.
Yes,
I really want a stuffed Bandrel. Like, I just want to snuggle with it at night. Like, that's why I want a stuffed animal. If one of
they were,
it just looks so fuzzy and cuddly.
They're sock puppets, so you could just make one out of your sock if you wish to.
Mm-hmm. I should, because that would be awesome. Because Bandrels rule, man. They're so sweet.
I've got this strange mental image right now of a spitting image Bandrel. I don't know why. It just came into my brain.
You guys are all far too well versed in British telly. You know, we were talking about Time Lash the other day, and it struck me that if that had been made in the 60s, even with the production values it has, but in black and white on, you know, 405 lines, it would have worked so much better, do you not think? It just seems to me that Time Lash is a bit more out of time, a bit too old-fashioned for where it is.
The web planet did not work in black and white in 405 lines.
Wow.
Planet of the Giants did not work in black and white in 405 lines.
Maybe. Okay then, Chris, seeing as you're on the spot, what's your first choice of a story for tonight?
One that is going to raise equal ire from Erica as I gave to her for Time Lash, no doubt. But Rick James's masterpiece, The Mutants, naturally. The Mutants is a story I've always had a soft spot for. I like the idea. I like the idea of the Time Lords making the Doctor their errand boy and saying, here, go be this FedEx delivery guy and find this one person who this package is meant for and which will only open for them. And we're not going to tell you anything about them or who they are. We'll give you the general planet and that's about it. But no, I like when Doctor Who does social commentary and of course, you know, the racism in South Africa and whatnot, parallels that can be drawn to the mutants are fascinating to my mind, and I don't know, I've just always liked it, and even Professor Sondergaard and his strange accent is okay.
There's nothing wrong with the mutants. There's nothing wrong with the mutants. As a matter of fact, it's one of the most brilliant stories of the Pertwee era, in my view.
The notion of the seasons. I mean, even yep. Andrew Smith later on in Full Circle adopted the same idea, essentially. And
yep.
how there's all these changes going on and nobody understands why, because they don't realize the grand scale of things.
Absolutely.
I was just going to say, Full Circle came up on the Memory Cheats the other week. And, you know, it's almost in some ways a remake, isn't it?
In some respects, yeah.
Well, insofar as it takes some of the same ideas and spins a Doctor Who story out of them.
Yeah, perhaps. I think that this particular story really puts a lot of emphasis on two areas, which is there is certain things that we don't understand that happen in nature, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that, you know, I think that they put a finer point on British imperialism here. And they did it very well. I mean, the particle reversal and, you know, George Pravda I love George Pravda and everything he's done in Doctor Who, which is quite a lot. And but the story itself is really good. And, you know, there was some very poor acting performances. I won't deny that, but I think the message overall was very, very strong. And I wish they named it something else besides the mutants. I wish, you know, if they had named it something, you know...
Like the Daleks.
I mean, if they had named it something that sounded like what it was supposed to be, it might have been better. But again, I mean, Salman Rushdie actually referenced the mutants. Not that that's a good thing or a bad thing, but... you know, British imperialism, and you put that together with a very strong story, and there were some strong cast members in this, you know, despite Rick
and
James.
The monsters, Josh, the monsters.
The costume, brilliant. The costumes were very well realized.
The monsters were so brilliant that you reutilized them in Brain Morbius. Come on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Yep. You don't get just any Doctor Who story opening like a Monty Python episode.
It's Monty Python.
The Armageddon factor is even worse, though. The opening on that is shocking. But we're not looking at the Armageddon factor.
No, we're
factor.
Not. We're not.
Thankfully, nobody has chosen to try defending it, because you can't.
No.
It's not in the bottom 20. Can. It's not in the bottom 20. So
that's true.
You
it's
go.
Not. So I don't know how it's not, but...
No, it's... Oh, dear, that has got to be the worst Tom Baker story. And there are some Tom Baker stories, well, one in particular that I really don't like.
Is it The Invisible Enemy, by any chance?
No, I've got a real huge soft spot
for
The
Invisible
Enemy.
Yeah, he likes The Invisible Enemy. I hate it, but...
We did The Invisible Enemy when we did this before. Mm. Erica, do you remember The Mutants?
I don't. If I saw it, it's when I was so young, I don't recall. Mm. So that's. But it has Pertwee in it, so I probably wouldn't like it.
Oh, fair enough. I think it's fine. I think when there's bad performances that are so bad they're funny, I don't mind things like that in Doctor Who, because, you know, if you look at it, if you're going to sit and watch 2.5 hours of telly at quite a stately place, pace. Sometimes you just need something to attract your attention, to keep you awake, even. And a really bad performance can help do that. And, you know, Paul Darrow in Time Lash, for me, keeps that story bubbling along nicely. Mm-hmm. And some of the acting in The Mutants does the same, really.
I have to wonder, like, did during his tenure on Doctor Who, did David Maloney watch The Mutants and say, I have to hire this Rick James person for Blake 7? Because, I mean,
yeah,
I've not seen him do anything but those two performances, and they're neither of them good.
Well, that's why you've not seen him in anything else. Maybe they thought, oh, it must have been a bad day back in 1972. he's got to be better than that.
I mean,
and obviously he wasn't.
To be fair, the character itself of Cotton. Oh God, I can't believe they named it Cotton. but the character itself, it was supposed to be a Cockney, and Maloney was thinking, and at least this is what the value added material on The Mutants tells us, is that he wanted to make it multiracial, like it should be. Mm. And unfortunately, he didn't exactly find the best actor for the role.
No.
Which is a shame.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, the next one is one of mine. I chose this, and this actually isn't in the bottom 20 of the Mighty 200, because this wasn't out at the time. But this does seem to be a story that has been roundly despised by fandom, and I quite like it, so I thought I'd bring it on and defend it. It's The Curse of the Black Spot. And to me, there seem to be four reasons in particular why people dislike this, so I think I'll go through them and try and defend them. Well, the first one is that coming after a two-part opening story from Stephen Moffat, it just doesn't seem very much of a story. It doesn't seem very important. And I think people just kind of looked at it and said, well, we've just had two amazing weeks from Stephen Moffat where you've got loads of arc story going on. This is the first time, Series 6, I think, is the first time where really you've got a lot of arc overtly in your opening story. Because with the 11th Hour, you really didn't quite know how much he was taking forwards and how much he wasn't. But in The Impossible Astronaut, you really got a sense of this is what the season's going to be about. And then The Curse of the Black Spot comes along, and it's not about that at all. And I think people just looked at it and said, you know, well, what a waste of a week. We want to find out what's going on with the girl, with the regeneration, with the silence. We want to know the answers to all these things. And of course, they're not in that story. So I think it got a bit of a backlash because of that. I think it got a bit of a backlash because they didn't immediately go off and look for Amy's baby. And, you know, Night Terrors got even more flack for that later on in the series, because by that point it was more clear that there was a baby that they should go looking for. But the whole Amy's pregnant, Amy's not thing is really glossed over at the end of The Day of the Moon. But in The Curse of the Black Spot, of course, she doesn't know she's pregnant. And even though the Doctor suspects she might be, you can't hinge the whole season on a suspicion of the Doctor's. You have to have those stories in between that aren't to do with the arc and that aren't to do with the continuing story. And I don't think it's a problem for The Curse of the Black Spot not to be about what's going on elsewhere.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm going to jump to its defense.
Yeah, go on, yeah.
I think it's not the fault of that story, its placement in the season. I agree that it's not maybe very well placed, but at least as far as that particular reason goes, I don't think people should hold it against The Curse of the Black Spot. And there are some legitimate complaints that people might have, but they're things that didn't really bother me.
Well, there was a couple of those legitimate complaints I was just about to come to. Just before I do, though, I was just going to say one more thing about that. You know, at the end of Series 6, there were so many people complaining there's too much arc in that series, and we hate The Curse of the Black Spot. And I'm thinking, well, hang on, you can't have it both ways. Because, you know, there are stories with no arc in, and The Curse of the Black Spot's one of them. But the two...
We're Doctor Who fans. It's our place to demand it both ways, I think. That's how it works.
Yeah.
The Curse of the Black Spot is also not completely absent of the arc, because there is the very brief shoehorning in of Frances Barber as the eye patch lady.
There is, but, you know, those are... They're a bit like Vam in the story, really. They're not part of the story. They're just like a little Vam for the people who are keeping up with the arc, really.
Story Vam.
That's how I look at those bits. To me, they're like, if you don't want to follow the arc, then they're easy to get past because it's just a few seconds on screen.
I suppose it's like the hurried and quieted mention of Bad Wolf by the Mox of Bellahoon in The End of the World.
Yeah, absolutely. If you don't spot it, or if you're not looking for it, or if you don't want to see it, it's not going to spoil your enjoyment of the rest of the episode. The two things in the Curse of the Black Spot...
No, it's the rest of the episode that spoils your enjoyment of the rest of the episode.
Well, I was going to say, the two things in Curse of the Black Spot that people really seem to have a problem with are A, the missing crew member, and B, the fact that the pirates know how to pilot a spaceship at the end of the story.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I never had a problem with the... Not much of a problem with the pirates, with, what's this,
The missing crew member?
No, I'm trying to remember the actor.
Captain Avery.
Yeah, Captain Avery, the actor. Anyway, the character of Captain Avery. He's brought into the TARDIS console room, and he figures that out because, in his words, a ship is a ship. And at the end of the day, that's you know, there's a certain truth to that, and... I can get behind him having a basic grasp of the controls of this spaceship, even though he's never stepped foot in one before.
Really?
Yeah, I can forgive that.
I can forgive it, but
Erica's vernacular, I can hand wave it.
You know what?
Josh, I
know how to drive a car, but I don't think I can drive a boat. So maybe. I think
they both have
actually,
a steering
wheel.
Actually,
I think you could.
But probably could. But I think that we're talking about is I don't think I could drive the space shuttle. Okay,
right.
Maybe I should use that as a better
analogy.
A better analogy. It just did work, but you know, I always thought Curse of the Black Spot was kind of middle of the road, not unwatchable by any stretch, but certainly not one of the best. And I don't think it's fair for me to say that, you know, this is one of my favorites, because it really just simply isn't. But it's okay. It doesn't bother me, and at the same time, I don't get excited enough to rewatch it.
Yeah.
Do you by any chance, Josh, rank it the lowest for Series 6 in your personal list?
I sure don't.
It's
would that be Almost People, Rebel Flesh?
If you not? Know, it's funny because like with Series 6, if Series 6 never happened, I'd be okay with it. I'm not a big Series 6 person. Would I rank it the lowest? Yeah, I think they all kind of fall into the same department for me. I don't have a love for a lot of the stories in Series 6.
Yeah, I actually rank the finales in Series 6 as the lowest.
Oh, wow, I love those.
Good for
but
you.
But then I love Series 6. It's my favorite.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And I would rank Curse of the Black Spot the bottom in Series 6, but I love the whole series. So, how's
you rank,
that?
You rank it at the bottom because something has to be there, not because it's necessarily the worst.
Yeah, probably so. That or Night Terrors. Look, going back to the end, them flying the spaceship, and the missing crew member. You know, how many times have we not seen somebody disappear or get killed in an episode of Doctor Who, and it's not a big deal?
All I can say to that is Josh's favorite story is the Android Invasion, and we all know what happens in part 4 of that one. So
absolutely. So, you know, a tiny little apparent plot illogicality there is not going to spoil the... But the ending... I mean, you know, if they're going to go off in a spaceship at the end, you could have a 5-minute scene where they say to the Doctor, hey, why don't we take this ship instead of the other one? And the Doctor says, oh yeah, that's an interesting idea. Why don't I show you how to fly it?
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd have a 5-minute scene like you do in Time Lash, in the second episode of the Time Lash, that 5-minute scene in the TARDIS that just halts proceedings, really slows things up. And, you know, takes the pacing, you know, completely out of what it should be. The Curse of the Black Spot, okay, the way I hand wave it away at the end there is I think to myself, well, what probably would have happened if this had been real life is the Doctor would have taught them to fly the spaceship.
Right, I mean...
But if it had been real life, you know, you wouldn't have had a spaceship, so I'm happy to forgive that the Doctor doesn't. Sorry, Josh, go on.
No, JR, I mean, if they did what they did at the end of Full Circle... Which is essentially, okay, here's the instructions. You know, this is...
Yeah, maybe.
And here's the big red button. Press that, and the rest of it's pretty easy. You know, maybe it's
perhaps,
forgivable.
But,
or,
you know,
rather than necessarily having to have a instruction manual scene or a demonstration of the controls scene... Why not just have a voice-controlled autopilot and say, "I want to go that way," and it goes.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, yeah,
there you go.
You get the brevity, and you get something so it seems reasonable that Avery can control the ship.
Yep.
Okay,
you just made it a lot better, Chris. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, maybe something like that existed and they just didn't bother. See, this is the kind of thing that I just sort of tend to fill in the blanks with in my own headcanon. And just,
we
don't
just
worry
didn't
about
see
that
it
stuff.
On screen.
Mm-hmm. We just coined that headcanon.
And I'll give
headcanon.
Yep.
I'll give the story massive props for evoking the Stones of Blood.
Exactly.
Yes,
yes. Well.
Okay, mm-hmm. I'll agree there. I'll totally agree there. I did feel the Stones of Blood piece, no doubt.
So we're all positive on the Curse of the Black Spot.
Bits and pieces, perhaps. Yes.
Wow. Okay, Josh, your turn next. And this is one that you and I both chose, but you're going to talk about it first. And it's Patrick Troughton. It is...
The Dominators. Yes, actually, this is the first Patrick Troughton I ever saw was The Dominators, for obvious reasons, because that's mm-hmm. what was available. And I loved it. I think the major thing that I really enjoyed about The Dominators, maybe not about the story necessarily, but Patrick Troughton in this, who is unbelievable. Yes. He is purely and truly the Doctor in this, and as you know, somebody who had watched every other Doctor at that point in time when I first saw this, I fell in love with Patrick Troughton right away after seeing this story. I think the major pieces for me were the fact that his ability to play stupid extremely well. That whole scene with him and the Dominators in there, and they're grilling him and making him take little tests, and he's on purpose failing these tests, was absolutely brilliant. He was so amazing in this, and the story itself wasn't too bad. You know, I think that the major thing that people have a problem with this story may be that, you know, the Dominators are kind of iffy as enemies, to say the least. But I think when you juxtapose that with a planet that is basically pacifist, and you have even the most basic villains from another world would have a huge amount of power over them, and it tells a story that, you know, being a complete pacifist isn't the right approach.
It's really funny, actually.
You're going to get walked on.
Yeah. It's almost like the anti-Malcolm Hulk. Because whereas Malcolm Hulk makes it so obvious, but he's left-leaning in politics, and most of his stories address that in some way. You can tell that Mervyn Haseman and Henry Lincoln were completely the opposite, because they've basically written this story that absolutely takes the mickey out of, you know, hippie culture of the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. This is what's going to happen to you hippies, is what the Dominator seems to say.
I'm completely with you, Josh, on in the sense that a culture like that could so easily be, for lack of a better word, dominated. the problem I have with the Dominators is Iffy doesn't even begin to cover it. They're just so ineffectual. They do nothing themselves. They seem incapable of doing anything themselves. The Quarks do everything. All they do is snipe at one another. And these are, it's fair enough if this, you know, even ever so moderately more malevolent race came to Dulcus and invaded, they would probably succeed in taking over. But these are supposed to be Dominators who, you know, their race is masters of the 12 galaxies or whatever I forget what wording, but they're supposed to be these uber badasses, and there's absolutely no hint of that in the characters.
Well, I mean, I mean, while I agree with that, I think that the message is that even though they have managed to dominate the 12 galaxies, that, you know, politics is something that will eventually get in the way, especially, I mean, as an American, I can tell you. politics will always get in the way of trying to be the badass, and you know, we're seeing these aliens in their true form, which is, you can have quarks, yes, but you know what, at the end of the day, you're just like everybody else, and you're not as good as you think you are, and I think that's a great message.
And you know, something else we see with the Dominators that you so very rarely see in Doctor Who, especially 1960s Doctor Who, is that they have individual personalities, and when you see them not getting on, that does actually make them feel more like a race of real people than, you know, when you've got the Ice Warriors and you've basically just got one who's got a speaking part and somebody else to say yes every now and again.
If not for the fact there are only two of them, which is a statistically invalid sample, I might agree with you, but because there are only two, we I think that's possibly flawed extrapolation.
Yeah, but at least they're trying.
They're trying.
Because you wouldn't get that with the Daleks. And the, you know, Daleks or Cybermen or whatever. The other thing I like about that, and I've got to say, the reason I like the Dominators is mostly for what Josh said. I just, anything with Patrick Troughton in, and especially that team with Fraser Hines and Wendy Padbury, I can just watch anything with those three actors in, and I'll lap it up. But the other thing, going back to the subject of Dalkis, it's also one of those very rare occasions where you don't see a society that looks like it could actually be real, with a fully realized hierarchy and cultures and all this kind of stuff. But it's very rare that you ever get to see more than one area of a planet. And in this story, at least you get to see that there are different areas of the planet, even if, unlike in, say, the Keys of Marinus, you don't actually get a full geography of it.
I don't know if it's part of the negative aspects I'm bringing up are courtesy Kyle and Eric from Doctor Who, the Writers' Room, who recently covered Haseman and Lincoln. But one thing that really, really bothers me is we've got a society here. Yes, they're pacifists now, and I don't know if the lack of studying warfare has reduced their overall societal ability to do anything useful. But you've got this culture that developed atomic weaponry, who nowadays isn't even scientifically intelligent enough to question why all this radiation in part of the planet has just out of nowhere evaporated. They don't question why. They're just like, oh, the half-life of the atomic blast is this. And it makes them seem like such a stupid people.
You're talking about Haseman and Lincoln now.
No, I'm talking about the Dalshans. I'm talking about the Dalshans.
Well, it makes them seem pretty stupid as well. But then it works for Bob Baker and Dave Martin, so, you know. They don't seem to understand nuclear physics either.
We accept so much anyway, right? I mean,
yeah.
So you try to find the things that you know, engage you, regardless.
I think we have that in the Quarks. I'll throw it out there. I love the Quarks. I love their voices.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do. Honestly, I love the Quarks. I love the voices. I like the design where you have one arm that sits above the other. Maybe the execution with them, you know, flapping their arms doesn't always work so well. But Haseman and Lincoln were trying to make the new Daleks, and they had limited success with Quarks appearing in comics and whatnot. But they were in
that
it.
Is true.
They were in it for the money. They were in it for the merchandising cash that never actually materialized. But I still love the Quarks.
Erica, we've not heard from you for a while. Are you still with us?
Yes, I just haven't seen the Dominators, at least that I remember.
Oh, that's all right.
I started reading the Target novelization, and then I had to sell all my books, so I never got through it.
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. That's an Ian Marta book as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I believe it is.
I'm trying to glance over my shelf, but it's too awkward an angle to read.
Yeah.
Mine are hidden away as well.
Also, JR, I have to admit that I liked the blonde in it. There was a blonde, very, very attractive blonde in it. So.
Which one is
you
he?
Are not another, wrong.
That's another reason I love the Dominators. Okay? All right? Is that an acceptable reason to love the Dominators? Okay.
Sure.
I think that's fair enough.
Okay.
Hey, I don't mind the cause of access because of Corporal Bell, so I'm with you on that.
You like Corporal Bell, huh?
A little bit. Okay. A little bit.
All right.
Oh, sweet. Well, at the end of the episode, we'll all take a vote on the most attractive one-story guest.
Corporal Bell was in two stories, but...
Oh, okay, yeah.
Less than three stories.
Less than three stories and you're fine. Erica, your next story, your next choice of story.
I am. Well, this is one where I feel like I'm just sort of piggybacking with Chris, because it's The Horns of Nymon, which I have to admit I haven't seen since probably 1994, but I have really, really happy, fond memories of it. And yes, I remember it being silly, but that's okay. I'm all right with Doctor Who being silly and over the top from time to time.
And I don't disagree. Chris, Horns of Nymon.
I didn't know if Erica was going to say any more than that.
No,
but
I
guess
I'll let you speak, and then if I think of something else, I'll jump in.
Please do. From a personal standpoint, there are two big things about the Horns of Nymon that always, always, always will give it a soft spot in my heart. One is one of my earliest memories of watching Doctor Who as a child, and I've said this I don't know how many podcast, but one of my earliest memories of watching Doctor Who as a child is the scene where the tributes are going through the maze and they come across the dried out husk of a body, and you know, Seth I think touches it and it collapses, or maybe it was Tika. Anyway, somebody touches it and the husk collapses, and that scene is forever burned in my gray matter. And number two, I am and always have been a sucker for Greek mythology, and the Minotaur legend is fantastic, and I've always enjoyed it. And even beyond those, I like there's a lot of conceptual things I like. I like this devious Nymon race whose one representative is there and convinces this otherwise what should be an intelligent species, not unlike the Dulcians, that you know, he's the last one of his race and he needs help and so on, and tricks them into facilitating a takeover. And I don't know, I like that. I like the idea of an ever-changing maze and the power complex.
Oh, that is brilliant.
It is. Even some of the acting, I don't mind Graham Crowden for part of it. No. Anyway, he's very extreme. The co-pilot with his weakling scum every 5 minutes, it seems, is endearing to me. I adore it.
It is I, Soldier.
And yeah, I don't know. I've always had a soft spot for Nymon, Horns of Nymon.
You know, there's a bit in, I think it's episode 3, where is it Romana travels to the last planet the Nymon were at, mm-hmm. and sees what happens there.
Yep. Yep.
And as silly and as frivolous and as, you know, Tom Baker-y maybe as the sort of 2.5 episodes are that get you to that point, with all the funny noises on the TARDIS console and, you know, some bad special effects and some overacting, you get to that point and that story takes a sudden turn for me, and that bit really gets me. That bit is really dark, mm-hmm. and really affecting, I think.
And also, for better or worse, incredibly convenient that this other planet has discovered this crystal that can stop the Nymon. But
well,
you need something, I suppose. And you mentioned poor special effects, but I'm going to counter that with fantastic model work on the power complex.
For its time.
Mm.
Well, the thing that always gets me is not the model work. I always think the model work's great, and then they overlay some really poor sort of laser effects or time mm-hmm. tunnel effects, and the illusion is shattered.
To be fair, it is season 17. Yeah. Inflation was rampant. Graham Williams could not control things very well because so many things were out of, just beyond his control at all. And they did what they could.
Imagine you get a budget, okay? And you figure out that budget's going to handle the season. And then mm-hmm. inflation occurs over the time in which you get the money against the time that you actually have to use it.
Yep.
And
because those funds are assigned in advance, so
right, yeah. and you just have nothing left. I love Horns of Nymon. I like Horns of Nymon because it's Tom Baker, and I love everything that is Tom Baker. And there's almost nothing that he did that I won't go and watch again. So, mm-hmm.
And you know, there are some stories that are, for want of a better word, classics or really good stories that you can put on, and if you're not in the right mood for it, they can be a little dull. But you put the Horns of Nymon on, and I dare you not to enjoy it.
I want to echo what Chris said about just being a sucker for mythology, because I am, and I definitely was, even when I was a little kid and first saw this, which I think that's one of the reasons that this story has stuck with me for so long, because when I was a really little kid, I already was really into Greek mythology and the gods and, you know, the myths and all that kind of stuff. So it planted a sort of a seed in me at a very young age. And I can imagine it would probably be different coming at it, watching it for the first time as an adult. But I don't think that necessarily is a bad reason to like something, because mm-hmm. you enjoyed it when you were a kid. I think sometimes people poo-poo that a little bit and they say, well, I watched this as an adult, that's why I don't like this. And, you know, it's sort of with the you shouldn't like it because you're an adult now and you're not a kid anymore. And I think that's dumb. I think maybe being an adult, sometimes you lose a little the whimsy of a child, and I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, and I don't think people should celebrate that so much. I think it's actually better if you can open yourself up and enjoy more things, because what's wrong with having more joy? Where is that ever a bad thing?
That is not a problem at all, enjoying things, is it? Having more joy in your life. And of course, Josh and I both like the Android Invasion, which for a kid is an absolutely wonderful Doctor Who story, but if you watch it as an adult, it doesn't quite work as well, does it?
Right. Yeah. Now, but I mean, season 17, I think overall, is the perfect 11-year-old Doctor Who. And it just so happens that I watched it as an 11-year-old, so
I was probably of a similar age when I saw it as well, and I think that's why I was on another podcast a couple months ago where following you and Steven, Josh, no less, talking about season 17, and I specifically asked to represent that season as a defender of it.
Good for you.
It deserves defense because of what it was trying to do and what it was successful in doing.
Actually, I listened to that, and you didn't do a very good job of defending Destiny of the Daleks, which is one of my favorite stories from that series.
That's the one story of the series I like the least.
Oh, I love it so much.
You know, the strange thing is, I was 11 too when season 17 came on, and then when season 18 came on, I was just like, this is so dull, this is not Doctor Who. And it wasn't until years later, when I sort of found out what fans like, that I suddenly realised everybody liked season 18 and hated season 17, and I was like, what? What the hell are you talking about?
And there's nothing wrong with liking them both, as I do.
Yes, and me too, I love them both.
Oh no, I've never fully managed to come around to season 18. Anyway, moving on.
So many good stories. that's for another podcast.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. No, I can't disagree. But we were talking a minute ago about the Greek sort of mythology. You know what, actually, if that Myths and Legends set would have been so better if they'd have found the Mythmakers and managed to smuggle that one in there as well, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it be? I read the Target book as a kid and just devoured it. And the other week, finally got around to listening to the audiobook version of the Target novelization is narrated by Stephen Thorne, and just had a blast for the 4 hours or so it lasted.
Wow. And the Time Monster is my next choice, which also has a little bit of Greek mythology in it. You know what? When I first saw the Time Monster, I thought, this is absolutely awful. And when the DVD... I did! And when the DVD came out, I was thinking, oh, I really don't want to watch this. But I did. And my partner, my girlfriend, was there, and she's not a big Doctor Who fan. And I thought, oh God, can I really show her the Time Monster? But I thought, no, I'll give it a try. And I put it on, and I think it's probably just about her favourite Doctor Who. And you know why? Because it was so bad, we had an absolute blast watching it. Mm. We laughed from start to finish. And it's not even that it's all that bad. A lot of what's in there are some really interesting ideas that just aren't particularly well realized. And there's some interesting characters and all sorts of other things that are so much of their time that the Time Monster seems to be a sort of congregation of ideas that are ahead of their time and characters that are behind their time, that somehow it just really doesn't match up. And the way it doesn't match up is so enjoyable. If you're going to put a story on just purely for fun, I could recommend far worse things than the Time Monster. It is a lot of fun. And we were talking about it the other week as well. And the one other thing I've got to say about it is so Stephen Moffat. There are so many things going on in that story. Science fiction and myth and legend and timey-wimey storylines and all this kind of thing. And the way he mixes in two different time zones and makes them seem totally part of the same story so that neither of them seems incongruous with the other. It all feels so Stephen Moffat, and it's just as funny as Stephen Moffat, but for all entirely different reasons.
You know, this is one that I another one that I haven't seen, and I didn't have time, unfortunately. But after you sent us this list, I almost watched it because I was so curious about it. Because Liz, my co-host on Verity, this is her favorite Doctor Who story of all time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yes, this is what she says is her number one. And she admits that it's quite ridiculous, but that's part of the reason that she loves it. And I think this is the one that she points to the end. Joe basically saves the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because she's the one that has the lack of hubris, I guess, to think that the rest of the world matters more than their lives do, where the Doctor kind of chickens out or something. And I like that idea, so I want to watch it with sort of an open mind and see which side of the debate I fall on. I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
I was going to say earlier that despite silliness and so on, there are some poignant moments in this. Like even, you know, Delia talking to the Master has some poignancy. Joe's pushing the button to force the time ram at the end. And correct me if I'm wrong, this is also the story with the Daisy is Daisy speeches in it. So
it is.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which was a fantastic moment in Doctor Who in my mind.
I remembered for all the wrong reasons, but at the time it happened. You know, it worked. It was the right thing in the right story at the right time. Of course, nowadays we take the Mickey out of that speech, but that doesn't mean it didn't work at the time it came out.
Fan perceptions fluctuate over the years.
Yeah,
they really do.
I wish I could remember off the top of my head which one it was, but on Doctor, the Writer's Room or Book Club podcast, Eric was talking of perceptions of stories and how, you know, at some point in time, everyone in fandom hates story X, and 10 years later, it's the sweetheart of everything, of every fan, so... I don't know.
It's like fashion. Bell bottoms are out this year. Bell bottoms are in this decade. Everything kind of comes around eventually.
Exactly.
Yeah. I guess actually, because John Pertwee years were so unfashionable for so long, and I suppose while they were, something like this, which is, you know, Barry Letts to the nth degree, this is really so Barry Letts. And everything that was kind of cheesy or slightly naff about Barry Letts that you could point at in terms of the things he liked to do, the CSO, and sometimes the sort of old-fashioned, quaint performances sometimes. This is a very Letts and Dix thing, you know. When Hinchcliffe and Holmes came in, they pushed the horror in Doctor Who, and the humour became far harder edged and far more sarcastic. I've always said the Letts and Dix years, the humour reminds me a bit of things like, what's that programme with the old folk? I can't remember what it's called. Set in the Yorkshire Dales or somewhere. No, not an American, but a British one. But it's what I'm saying is Letts and Dix seem to have a really old fashioned sense of humour that was really easygoing. And I think the Time Monster is kind of the epitome of that. You know, one of the big action sequences in the Time Monster is somebody falling off a ladder. You know, a window cleaner falling off a ladder. It's like, you can't get more daft, more ridiculous, more low-key. And, you know, after Ambassadors of Death, the Time Monster is totally at the other end of the spectrum, isn't it? In terms of those kind of things. And yet, for me, it just works. I kind of like that, and this is the epitome of that.
And there are enough silly bits to counter it as well. I mean, the time detection device that Pertwee's Doctor constructs out of the cork and the forks and all that is rather ludicrous. But even that gets an homage in the new series. So,
yeah. Speaking of the new series, Chris, I mean, I think that we had our version of the Time Monster in the new series. It was called Father's Day. And I think it was done a lot better. It was done a lot better there. With the Reapers. But the idea of a monster that sort of ate time, is a really interesting one. And, you know, while I don't think it was executed all that well in the Time Monster, and I love the name Kronos because I actually work for a company with that name. It wasn't pulled off very well. It looked like it was pulled off as quickly as possible. It looked like one of those David Agnew quotation fingers writing jobs. And as a result, it didn't work, and it didn't work for the 6 episodes. But some of the ideas were really good, and if they were able to tail it back to 4, or if they were actually able to manage it into a little bit of a more cohesive story, it would have worked. It's a good idea.
The best thing about the Time Monster? The Master has another evil plan, and he calls that evil plan Tom Tit.
Yes, he does.
Tom Tit.
And of course, we get to end the episode on a laugh with a naked Sergeant Benton.
Yes. Oh, yes. Right, we better move on. Josh, I'll come to you for this next one. You and Chris have chosen this, and I have to say, I think you're going to struggle persuading me that this has got much of any value in it.
I don't think I can struggle. I mean, the Space Museum is on the list here, and I think what you need to do, JR, is you need to go back and watch episode 1. Just forget about the last 3 episodes and watch episode 1 again, okay? Because episode 1 is one of the greatest Doctor Who single episodes ever to be put on the air, okay? And the reason is because they investigated an area where they jumped a time track, okay? They saw their own future in this story, and they've worked the entire story to prevent that future. How could that not be an amazing idea, particularly at the time in which this was written, back in 1965? I think it's brilliant.
Okay.
It's brilliant.
So far, so good. Persuade me to watch the other 3 episodes.
I'm big on concept. I love bold ideas, and this has one of the boldest ideas Doctor Who has ever presented, because Doctor Who, as a time travel show, does not often talk about time travel.
Agreed.
And that's lamentable. But this one, oh man, they skip the time track, as Josh said. There's all these side effects of, you know, they're in these glass cases, and until they see them, there's this mystery of, why aren't they leaving footprints in the dirt? Why can't they open doors? Why can't they do whatever? And it's so enthralling, and just gets the juices flowing in the brain and makes you want to know more. And as far as why to watch the other episodes, William Hartnell in a Dalek shell, the doctor being interrogated, and with they have the thing hooked up to his mind, so what he visualizes in his mind shows up on the screen, and is so incongruous to what is being asked of him, and it's just such a charming sequence.
Yes,
but it feels like a Patrick Troughton sequence, that, actually, doesn't it?
It is very like Josh spoke earlier of Troughton's Doctor and the Dominators, and the tests that were undertaken, and it's the flippancy with which Hartnell undertook that was just, it's just amazing. I loved it.
Yes.
And then, you know, you've got overlords and revolution and invasion and double sets of eyebrows and Boba Fett, and I don't know. I've always loved the Space Museum.
Hal the Archer. Always. Hal the Archer, of course, Chris.
Yes, exactly.
And his eyebrows.
Yes.
It's him with the eyebrows, isn't it?
It's the entire race with the double eyebrows.
Oh, God, yes. No, the Space Museum, yes. Space Museum, love the first episode. Really struggle with the other 3. But then, you know, when I do struggle with the other 3, I remind myself that back in 1965, when this was first on, even those other 3 episodes would have seemed light years away from anything else that was on television at the time. And although it seems cliched and obvious to us now, it wouldn't have then. So if you try and remember where it came from when you watch it, it's really not as bad as you think it is.
Mm-hmm. And people point to certain surrealistic aspects of Doctor Who as being strange or unique or outstanding, such as Planet of Giants or The Mind Robber, and I would point to this in the same breath, to mix metaphors.
Yeah, I can't disagree. Erica, would you like to tell us what our next story is and why we should like it?
Well, our next story is Fear Her. And I guess I wouldn't tell anybody that they should like it, but I am completely baffled by why people hate it. I don't understand at all. I mean, the first time I saw it, I thought the bit with the Olympics was completely stupid. And I still think that.
That's because
dumb.
It is.
Yeah. Mm. But so what? It's a tiny little bit at the end, and it actually does make sense in the context of the story. I think it's a little over the top, but when you look at the story and what it takes to get this alien race back where it needs to go, what could be better? I mean, it's silly, but it works. And people point to the Scribble Monster and complain about that. And why? It actually looks pretty good. I don't understand why people have a problem with that. It's, yeah, it's out of the mind of a kid, but that's what a Scribble would
look
like.
Not to mention it's all of 5 seconds.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the Scribble Monster.
Yeah, I think it's very creative and inventive, and I think that's neat. And yes, the child actor who played Chloe was not good, but like I said before, if you're watching for, the sets or the performances and stuff, you're watching it kind of for a different reason than I am.
I never had a problem with her,
Oh, see, I do. I have a major problem with her.
Oh,
but
really?
it doesn't ruin the story for me, because I'm used to looking past bad performances in Doctor Who.
And the rest of it is really, apart from the stuff with the Olympics, the rest of it is really actually no better or worse than any other sort of mid to late season, fairly cheap Doctor Who story. Mm-hmm. And it makes up for the cheapness by having some really good actors in it. Nina Sasanya's in it, and mm-hmm. she's a fantastic actress. And there's some really interesting bits. And
I just
think it's
a very touching story. I mean, when I think about what the alien is and the plight of that poor, baby or many babies, whatever it is, like that just, it tugs at my heartstrings.
Billions of babies, and I think
it doesn't always have to be something evil,
right,
to dominate the world.
Exactly,
does it?
And you're touching on some serious themes here. We're talking about domestic abuse and children's issues, and I think that all of those things, yes, could it have been better? Absolutely, if he would have gotten done a few things better here and there, but I don't think that those failings were bad enough that it should be as decried as it is. So I just I kind of scratch my head a little bit, and I don't understand. I think sometimes people just like to have at least one story they can complain about, so they take the one they like the least and vilify it crazily.
Fear,
and I think people should stop that.
Fear Her is the whipping boy of New Who. There's no question of that. But I mean, just as in watching series 2, just as the week before, Doctor Who doesn't always do fellatio jokes, Doctor Who doesn't always address things like domestic abuse, and that's a big, serious topic.
Doctor Who doesn't do fellatio jokes. Oh, Lord. We're not even going to talk about love and monsters.
You have a filthy mind, Chris. That's only a fellatio joke in your mind.
No, it's
right,
fellatio.
And everybody else's.
Not just my mind. Not just my mind. But
and you're somewhere else. No, I didn't say that.
The thing that I'll always remember about Fear Her, and why I can enjoy it despite the Chloe Weber character, despite the council worker, despite the Olympics, despite the announcer on the TV talking at the end, I loved the cheapness of it, in the sense that you didn't need much to evoke strong reactions. I loved the psychological thriller aspect of it, with the father in the closet, even if it is just a cartoon, a crayon drawing, it doesn't matter. It's in a red light. It's, to me, it made me think of Edge of Destruction, just this tight little cast. And this psychological thriller angle to the story, and you don't really know what's going on, and you're trying to guess the whole way, and it was good stuff to a degree.
I think that Eric is absolutely right, and that fandom has chosen this story as their whipping boy. New Who has maintained a certain level of quality from start to finish, and I don't think there are any stories that have dipped below a certain level of quality. But you're quite right, something has to come last, and I think that's just become more and more emphasized over the year, so that now Fear Her has become a byword for something that doesn't really exist in my mind.
I think, like we were talking of earlier, Curse of the Black Spot is, for a lot of people, the worst, or at least some people, the worst of Series 6, because there just has to be something on the bottom. And Fear Her is the worst of New Who just because something has to be on the bottom.
Well, I think maybe it's worth challenging that thought that something has to be on the bottom. I mean, I know that we are all nerds, and the nerd brain thing to do is to want to organize things and rank them and put them in lists and stuff. But I, at least myself, have really in the past couple years tried to get away from doing that, because when you do that, you're making something the worst. And it's okay to just like everything. And when you're not, if you don't make yourself point out exactly what is the worst, it's a lot easier to see the good things in everything.
You make something the worst, and as a byproduct, you marginalize it.
Exactly.
And you forget about some of the good stuff that Fear Her has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's
go on, sorry, Josh.
It's also taste, okay? So, you know, I love Doctor Who. I think people know that. I don't love all of Doctor Who. I mean, not everything is going to be something that I enjoy and that I have a rewatch factor with. And it doesn't mean I won't watch it. It doesn't mean I don't appreciate it. It doesn't mean that it's terrible. It just means that for some reason, it just didn't hit my taste. And when you have 50 years of history, you're going to find things that maybe don't hit your taste. And that's okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's okay. I think that's absolutely right.
It's okay not to like something, too. It's okay to say, you know, and not, you know, put a rubber stamp on it just because it has the name Doctor Who on it, that we're going to like it. I just think, you know, I would never not appreciate the fact that it's still with us, right? And you got to really enjoy regardless, which is something I couldn't have said back in the late 80s.
Yeah, I think you're right, Josh. You bring up an important point that it is okay to not like everything, and that's another thing that we should shy away from, berating people just because they don't like the things that are at the top of this list. I mean, honestly, I would rewatch anything we've talked about today before I'd watch Caves of Androzani again. Twice.
And I agree with you. I totally agree with you on that point.
And I wanna...
That's a shock for a few people.
Yeah. Just to throw out another callback here, JR, you spoke of The Curse of the Black Spot rubbing a lot of people the wrong way because it came where it did in an arc-heavy season, and Fear Her is going to suffer from the same thing. I think no matter what came before Army of Ghosts and Doomsday and the... you know, the pile driver that delivered to a lot of people, people are, there's no, whatever came 11th was going to get slagged.
And of course, it's got that very final scene at the end where they look up at the sky and say those lines. Yeah. And that kind of signals it, doesn't it? It says next week's going to be better than we've had this week. And it's almost as if that episode's admitting defeat. In
sort
a way,
of, yeah.
It feels like it, doesn't it? They could have left that off. It wouldn't have mattered if they'd have left that off. But it's almost like that episode's kind of saying, apologizing for its existence.
Yeah.
I suppose that gets reinforced the week after when in the cold open you have Billy Piper's voice saying, "This is the day that I died." So, or the story of how I died or whatever it was. Yeah.
You know, I was going to say while we were talking about... you know, people aren't always going to like everything. But I think the other danger is that if people don't like something, they'll assume that's because it's bad rather than just because it doesn't appeal to their taste sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I do the reviews for Starburst, one of the things they said at the start was that they score everything, because I'd never scored things before and had no, you know, it wasn't something that I would have done if they hadn't have asked me to. But when I do score things, you know, I don't think I've ever scored anything less than 6. And people say to me, well, if you don't score things less than 6, then A, that must mean you like everything, and B, it means it has no value when you really like something. But then I think I've not seen a Doctor Who story since it came back that wasn't worth 6 points. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Even the worst of them, The Curse of the Black Spot and Fear Her and The Rings of Akaten, I don't think any of those stories were worth less than 6 out of 10. So I'm not going to apologize for scoring everything 6 and up. And if I really like something, I'll give it a 10, you know?
And I don't think I've ever watched an episode of Doctor Who that has made me want to just turn it off and stop. I'm talking the very first time. You know, maybe the fourth time I go through the web planet, I'm less less likely to finish it in one sitting. But the first time watching something, I've never thought, I need to turn this off because it's utter garbage. That's never happened with Doctor Who. Mm-hmm.
It astonishes me when people do that. Oh, I stopped watching. Or, oh, I, you know, well, 15 minutes into this episode, I went into the kitchen and cooked my dinner. And I'm thinking, what? You did what?
Well, there's one friend of mine in London who watched episode one of The Twin Dilemma, refused to watch the last three parts when they went out, and I think until the DVD came out, had never sat down and watched it, and that was 20-whatever years between those two events.
Unbelievable.
And just refused to watch it because of... He hated the way the Colin Baker Doctor was set up in episode one, and it just turned him right off. And or people who started watching Sylvester McCoy and decided, nope, can't do this, and they'll just stopped watching Doctor Who altogether.
Well, you know, I guess I can... I certainly didn't feel that way, but I can understand it. If you're really not enjoying something, I think it's the healthy thing to do is to just stop.
Maybe,
rather than stick in there and watch it and just hate it and complain about it.
But, yeah, and if you have that visceral reaction to need to stop, fair enough. I've just never had it. Not with Doctor Who.
You know, as well, there's a thing lately that, especially since Tennant, you know, and I'll use this expression, the Tennant fangirls who stopped watching when Matt Smith came on. And they're not Doctor Who fans, they're David Tennant fans,
right,
who happen to like Doctor Who while Tennant's in it.
You got it.
But then I also think to myself, the people who think all of Doctor Who should be like season 7 aren't Doctor Who fans either.
True.
They're season 7 fans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the bit of Doctor Who they like. They like Doctor Who when it's like season 7. And so they really like Caves of Androzani and really didn't like The Twin Dilemma. But that doesn't mean The Twin Dilemma is any less Doctor Who than The Caves of Androzani is.
Mm-hmm.
It just means that Caves of Androzani appeals more to the season 7 fans.
Perhaps.
You're here.
or whatever, right? That's the greatest thing about it is that...
Yeah.
And I think that the difference is that today there is a lot more push to gain notoriety with not such a niche audience as well, right? So
I don't think it's any more than it was at the time. I think in season 7 they were actually trying to cast the net farther and get away from the niche audience just like they're doing now. I honestly think this is history repeating itself.
Oh, you're probably right, Erica. I mean, and it was successful, right? I mean, you can look at it from that perspective. It was completely successful.
It's a big one.
But, you know, we do see the people, the YouTube videos of the
singular one.
The Matt Smith fans, like, losing their drawers because Peter Capaldi is the new Doctor, right?
Yeah.
You know?
There was one.
And,
there were
several.
Everybody has seen.
Oh, really?
There were several. Okay, I've seen at least three.
There's the one that's going to stand out in everybody's mind.
Oh yeah,
I'm
of
sure.
course, of course, of course. But I mean,
it was hilarious.
The fact of the matter is JR, I think you're right. I think that we, you know, the average fan, the passive fan, you know, is looking for actors, and the heavy Doctor Who fan is just looking for Doctor Who, and that's it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we would all accept just about any actor or actress, as it turns might have turned out, as the Doctor until such time as we've seen them, and we might have determined that we don't. But it's highly unlikely that most of us as fans would turn it down, because it is Doctor Who, and we have it every day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's always, even with the same writer, there's always a chance that they're going to surprise you with the next script,
mm-hmm.
with the next story,
either badly or good.
If you want to talk series 7, throw Neil Cross's name at the top of that list.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. He had
absolutely
one of the most polarizing scripts, and then one of the ones that was the most lauded.
Unifying. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Anyway, we ought to continue with the next... Well, we've got two stories left, and one of them is one that I've brought up. And probably for similar reasons as we've been talking about just now, but Paradise Towers. I've mm-hmm. talked about this on this podcast before, but at the risk of repeating myself, and for the benefit of you three, you know, to a certain extent, I think they discovered a new way of making Doctor Who in Paradise Towers. something that they had done perhaps by accident as much by design before, but something that actually set down a template for how the rest of Sylvester McCoy's era would be. And that is, they had so little money that the story almost is almost told entirely as a metaphor. There's nothing in Paradise Towers that you can accept as potentially real. Everything in it seems... I mean, they've used the expressions graphic novel and cartoon strip and like a comic strip. But what they're really saying is it works as a parable. It works mm-hmm. as a fairy story. It's not like a fairy story. It is a fairy story. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time Doctor Who has sort of, for a sustained period, done that kind of storytelling. Because, you know, a lot of the rest of the McCoy era that follows works in that same way.
And something that was adopted for season 5 of the new show, too.
Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I think at the time that was probably a problem for people because they didn't get it. And I know I didn't. I didn't like Paradise Towers when I first saw it. And now I think it sparkles with invention. And I just think the dialogue and the storytelling, the ideas, the performances, the acting, everything about it is wonderful. And if you take away the surface cheapness of it, it's a brilliant, brilliant story. And I love it.
That's one that I haven't seen since my last great rewatch of 1994. And at that time, I think I was kind of still where you were, JR, the first time you saw it. I really didn't like the Sylvester McCoy era particularly at all. I mean, I went through it and watched it because I wanted to, you know, I'm a completist. But I really haven't gone back since then to give the whole thing another chance. So I will be interested once I get to that story to see what my reaction is now, looking at it with sort of a broader perspective, both on Doctor Who and on the world in general.
Mm. Yeah,
go ahead, Josh.
Oh, no, I just said it misses with me because it, while the stories of that era could have been so good, and I think about Ghostlight in that vein. While the stories could be so good, the execution of these stories were so bad that it really takes away from it. And, you know, creating that world, creating this world that doesn't conform is something that was done a lot in the Cartmel era. You know, Happiness... I always get Happiness Patrol and Paradise Towers mixed up because I just see them similarly. And actually, Greatest Show in the Galaxy kind of falls into that category as well, where there's this creation of this world and it seems a lot more fantasy than real. And I know this is science fantasy, blah, 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 blah. But it doesn't go well with me. And neither did The Beast Below, which is something that is very similar in that
vein.
Very
similar, yeah.
Right? Yep. And all of those types of stories don't really gel with me very well. And it's not to say that they're not good and they don't have great stories and they don't have great ideas, but it just doesn't do it for me from a Doctor Who standpoint. And Rings of Akatan also, I think, falls into that category. I mean, so many of these, like, you know, you got this kind of world that falls in the category of something that would be something somebody would fantasize of a world existing. So...
I did not pick a story from New Who to discuss on here, but if I did, it would probably be The Beast Below. But as far as Paradise Towers is concerned, I've always had a soft spot for it. I've always adored it, and I maybe don't read enough of the essay compilation books to have seen it mentioned before, but I love the notion of comparing Paradise Towers to a graphic novel in the sense that you've got this heightened reality of this unrealistic yet somehow realistic or plausible world where everyone is just a little off, and it just works for me. I mean, Pex is not a character you're going to see in a lot of stuff. The two old women are not characters you're going to see in a lot of stuff. Richard Briers' over-the-top performance as the chief caretaker, the idiocy of the caretaker crew in general, it's the Kangs. Man, I love the Kangs. I love the way the Kangs speak. I love how you know, common objects have become their names, and the way their diction has shifted from what we would normally expect to see from or hear from humans.
And it's so much more intelligent than Doctor Who had been for the last few years.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I suppose that's fair to say.
I think it's a real rebirth of, you know, Doctor Who tugging at the brain strings rather than the brawn springs.
And
to coin a phrase.
I like it.
One fantastic thing that sometimes really pays off for me is I don't notice music in Doctor Who, so the score from Paradise Towers is not one that's etched into my brain as something overly negative.
Right, we've got one more story to talk about. So, Chris, seeing as you have the floor, do you like to tell us what it is and why we should like it?
Absolutely. Underworld.
Hooray!
This is the third, by my count, of the 10 or so stories on this list that's rooted in Greek myth. And, man, I love Underworld. As much as Josh was saying, episode one of the Space Museum is one of the best episode ones ever produced by Doctor Who, I would put Underworld forward as one of the best episode ones of any Doctor Who story.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I have to agree.
You've got, oh man, the minions and the fact that the Time Lords got so cocky they intervened in the minions' lives, and this was one of the, if not the final straw in the Time Lords adopting the non-intervention policy, and how much damage they've done to these guys, and you know, with essentially immortality and. The quest is the quest. I love the quest. But, you know, Jason and the Argonauts is not one of my favorite stories from Greek legend and myth, but the Underworld is just, the performances are fantastic, and I even love the robots and the shield guns, and I don't mind the CSO. I'm sorry. The CSO,
yeah, you know what?
It's fine.
Chris, it works for the most part.
Oh my God! The reason why people don't like this is because of the CSO. I mean, it's not because of the story.
It's only because we're watching it on televisions that are about three times the size of the ones that we would have been watching it on in 1978. Anyway,
it's still not the worst when it comes to that either. I mean, you know, I mean they did amazing things with this. To be able to do this show with very, very little money is the most amazing thing in the world. And yet at the same time, the story really worked too. And it was engaging, and it made sense.
And how many Doctor Who stories have a happy Ray? Come on.
Yeah, come on. I love the happy Ray. I want one of those that work.
If I'm going to borrow a phrase from Erica's husband, in my mind the flaw in the Persian rug is the lack of credulity as far as the minion race banks and the fission grenades looking the same. I mean, that's there for plot convenience, obviously, but I could have done without that. Other than that, man, I love that story to bits.
Yeah, I think that didn't even hit my, you know, like, I didn't even think about that. Didn't even come.
Why is it down at the bottom? It's unbelievable.
I just don't get it. This is one of my favorite Leela stories, actually. I mean, her character towards the end of her run wasn't always as sharp, I think, as she started out. But I quite like that in this story you really see how far she has come as a character, because she is in a situation where she knows far more about the universe and technology than these poor people who are stuck in this planet or underneath this planet.
Oh,
and
great point.
She takes the role, and like she'll have these like sort of knowing nods, and she'll explain things very simply because she's Leela, but she still knows way more than the other characters, and it's just cool to see her almost smugness because, you know, she understands the stars.
It's great. I never even thought about that, Erica, but that's a really good point. I mean, you see the character development of Leela, and how she's changed over time, and how much she knows now versus the way she, I mean, everything that they tried to do with Leela, they actually made work in Underworld.
So it pays off. Mm-hmm.
It totally does.
And you know something else about this story, something that I think always gets forgotten, is that after Hinchcliffe and Holmes, obviously the Doctor Who production team were told, tone down the scares. So there's no scares in this story, but there's something genuinely eerie about quite a lot of this story, I think. Mm-hmm. Sort of, in part one, you've got the sort of, you know, this race of people who aren't Time Lords, but are doing Time Lord things. The robots you mentioned before, Chris, I find those robots really spooky. And the bit with the Doctor at the end of episode two, with the gas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I find all that sort of, all that kind of stuff, you know, when I was watching this when I was 8 or whatever it was, I'm positive I found this story just as scary as I found things like The Deadly Assassin.
Mm-hmm. And this is another one that absolutely stuck with me and just really hit me on a deep sort of emotional level, thinking about these people, that their view of the world was something completely different from what it actually was. And that concept just, I mean, even that comes through a little bit in Time Lash, all of the people, you know, thinking that the Borat is something that he's not. And I think that particular sort of trope on a fundamental level speaks to me really deeply. And I think it's done here in Underworld one of the best times in all of Doctor Who.
Just remember, if it can blow, it can be sucked.
Okay? I was waiting for somebody to say that.
Yep. Thanks for that, Josh. I'm the one that gets. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I'm just as bad as you.
Bad
Chris,
rep for the
fellatio
joke.
Yeah, I'm just. Oh, no. I'm just as bad as you.
So I think we can all agree that Underworld is nowhere near as bad as its reputation would suggest. Then,
absolutely
not. Yeah.
Well, guys,
Erica, I think you hit the nail on the head about the CSO. About the CSO being the, whoever said it. I'm sorry if it wasn't you. Anyway, whoever said the CSO is what people pick on, just like people pick on the Olympics in the fear in Fear Her. There's so much more to it, and just watch the story.
It's just an excuse when you pick on something like that, isn't it?
If you're watching for special effects, you are watching Doctor Who for a very different reason than I am.
Right, guys. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
I think it's just been so nice to talk for 60 minutes or so about stories that don't get a lot of love for not very good reasons.
Yeah, I agree.
And I like that we don't always agree with one another on on the level of love the stories should receive.
True.
Yes.
But we've managed to find some anyway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Right, until next time then, I was JR.
I was Chris.
I was Erica.
And I was Josh.
And we'll speak again soon. And for those of you who aren't aware, Christopher Burgess, not to be confused with the Christopher Burgess who played the role of Professor Phillips in Terror of the Autons, is a member of the Radio Free Scaro podcast. Erica Ensign, who tweets under the rather wonderful pseudonym Holly Go Darkly, is a member of the Verity podcast, and Josh is a member of more podcasts than I care to mention, notable among them The Memory Cheats and Mostly Harmless Cutaway. Tonight's new arrangement of the theme music comes from the funktastic Momo Tempo, also known as Tim O'Peach. Finally, it is good night from me.
And it's good night from him.
Good night.